BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, it's 818 days since Russia began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And we have had a lot of messages from you in recent weeks, especially in the last few days because of our conversation with Mike Pompeo, former US Secretary of State under Trump, former CIA director under Trump. And it's fair to say that, well, it was mixed, really. Some of you thought, gosh, he was quite spiky. Some of you were actually really pleased at how fully he was supporting Ukraine's fight against Russia. You listened, didn't you, Jamie?
Yeah, it was fascinating, I have to say. It was a really interesting interview. And yes, predictably, a range of comments, and we're going to be hearing some of them. But we'll also be discussing some of the other issues that are swirling around still. Of course, the recent offensive in the Kharkiv region, the future of the war, the broader prospects for a peace settlement as well. And also the fact that, elections were due to take place. They are not taking place in Ukraine for obvious reasons. But what does the fact that Volodymyr Zelensky is now past when he was due to be up for re-election, although, of course, he said he wouldn't stand for re-election when he was voted in 2019. What does that tell us about where Ukraine is when it comes to democracy, and what kind of impact might that have on the war, on broader support for Ukraine?
We've got lots of questions from you, our listeners around the world, which we'll attempt to answer today with the help of a former leading general in the British Army.
This is Ukrainecast.
Ukrainecast from BBC News.
Evil cannot be trusted. Ask Prigozhin.
You are not dealing with a politician, but with a bloody monster.
Is there a need for a serious opponent? Why?
Ukraine is unbroken, unbowed, and unconquered.
It's not just about Ukraine. It's about the whole future of Europe.
I don't understand what this war is for.
Hello, this is Victoria Derbyshire in the BBC Radio Car.
Hello, this is Jamie Kamara-Sami in the Ukrainecast studio.
And it's the first time we have hosted Ukrainecast together. Normally, we would be on air at pretty much the same time, Jamie, wouldn't we? Except I'm on BBC Two in the UK and you're on Radio 4 in the UK.
Yes, I was thinking that. This is, I suppose, appropriate, isn't it? We are on at the same time, but in different studios. So it would have been a bit odd if we'd been in the same studio together. Anyway, very nice to be with you, Victoria.
Yeah, and thank you for depping for Vitaly. And let's introduce you to General Sir Richard Barons, former commander of the UK's Joint Forces Command. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to be here.
Welcome to Ukrainecast. I wonder if you could just, because we have listeners right around the world, why don't you just explain what being commander of the UK's Joint Forces Command involves?
Like most countries, the UK obviously has an army, a navy and an air force. And since about 2010, it's had a fourth element, originally called Joint Forces Command, now called Strategic Command, which is the entity that glues all of those things together and looks after the so-called joint enablers, like intelligence and special forces. And in doing that job, I was one of the six UK chiefs of staff that run UK defence.
That is a big and important job. And it means that you're perfectly placed, Richard, to answer some of the questions we have from our listeners. But we're going to start by talking about what's happening in the region of Kharkiv, because you told our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, back in April this: there is a serious risk that this is the year Ukraine loses the war. And the reason this could be the year is because Ukraine may come to feel it can't win the war. And when it gets to that point, why will people want to fight and die any longer just to defend the undefendable? Do you still believe that, Richard?
So I still firmly believe that general proposition, although I think some of the urgency of what was becoming a crisis this year has dissipated, because the US Congress eventually passed a $60 billion worth of military aid, and that ammunition and equipment is arriving just in time to stem the current Russian offensive, which still has some weeks, maybe months to play out.
Well, Richard, let's talk about that offensive in the northeast region around Kharkiv, because a Ukrainian official said on Monday Ukraine still controls about 60% of Vovchansk. That's that town not far from the border with Russia, very close, in fact, in that region. And it's been pretty much the epicenter of the fighting. Now, we managed to get through to Yaroslav, who's a volunteer aid worker.
We're providing first aid in Vovchansk and acting as a rapid response group. When I was last in Bovchansk, it was so loud. There were many casualties, both injured and dead. Constant artillery shelling, mortar shelling and airstrike occurred. Each day it got worse, and the number of casualties only increased. We treated over a dozen wounded, providing first aid and helping to evacuate them. We saw a lot of destruction, many destroyed homes, and several times we were specifically targeted. I do not have exact information, but looking at previous data, we evacuated definitely more than 1,000, and I think there are about 200 to 300 civilians left. People are leaving Bovchansk because it is dangerous, because their homes are being hit, because their lives and houses are being destroyed. They're fleeing to save their lives.
That's one aid worker around Bovchansk. What do you make of where things stand at the moment on the ground, Richard? Is the fighting as intense as it was? What is your assessment of whether Russia is going to try or is continuing to make gains there?
It is one part of a general Russian offensive, and it seems pretty clear that the point of main Russian effort remains in the Donbass. And the attack around Kharkiv could have perhaps one or more of four possible objectives. The first is that Russia intends to move Ukrainian forces away from the border with Russia because that makes it much harder for Ukraine to fire at Russian military activity in Russia itself. And President Putin has talked about the need for some sort of border safety area. The second objective, which I think is more worrying, is if they were able to move far enough into Ukraine in that part of the country, and they could bring us more of their artillery within easy range, so roughly 20 kilometers or so of Kharkiv, that artillery in quantity could make life untenable in that city in the way that we've seen attempted in places like Kherson. That would be a significant gain for the Russian military campaign. And it doesn't involve occupying the city. It just means being able to fire into it at length and at will. And the third objective, if they were successful a little more, would be to try and isolate or cut off Kharkiv so that it became essentially a loss to Ukraine in that you couldn't supply it, move people in and out easily, or support daily life there. I don't think that is currently particularly likely. And even less likely is the fourth objective, where Russian forces would enter and occupy Kharkiv. And that seems to be beyond the numbers of troops, currently around 30,000, and their performance so far. But what we have seen is a very rapid response from the Ukrainian armed forces to slow or stop the Russian advance. But that comes at the cost of moving elite troops, special forces and others, and redirecting scarce ammunition to do that whilst the operation in the Donbass continues unabated. And that's why I come back to my first point, is we have to look at a general Russian offensive this summer, pushing on, I think, currently around 5 points on 1,000 kilometers of frontage, and Ukraine has to cover all of those bases.
Before we bring in one of our Ukrainecast listeners, what's your view about the prospects for peace and when, Richard?
So the first point is, President Putin would agree to stop fighting tomorrow if we all just gave up, if Ukraine decided that it didn't want to fight any longer. And he would have successfully occupied some 18% of Ukraine. He wouldn't have achieved, by any standards, his opening objectives, but he would have established a land bridge to Crimea. He would feel vindicated, and based on the performance after 2014 to up to 2022, there'd been low confidence that this was anything more than a pause. From a Ukrainian perspective, that is an intolerable proposition. The future of Ukraine is still in some jeopardy, certainly in terms of its terrain, if much less now in terms of the viability of a Ukrainian state. But Ukraine is not ready to stop. And because that issue is not resolved, and because Russia is still ambitious and aggressive, there's no real prospect of a meaningful peace talks now.
Well, I think at that point, we can bring in a long-time listener to Ukrainecast. I feel a bit of a fraud bringing her in, because I've a relative new recruit to the team. But Olivia in Dublin, in Ireland, is with us. Hello, Olivia. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Jamie. Yes, I have been listening since the beginning. I don't think I've missed an episode, maybe once when I was away, but yeah, avid listener.
Yes, and I was told you've missed one, and I wondered which one it was.
I think it was back in June last year when I was in America, and I just didn't get it.
Well, look, I'm sure you want to chat to Victoria as the...
Hi, Olivia.
Hi, Victoria. Hi, hey. How are you?
I'm really well. I'm so grateful for your loyalty, honestly. We never underestimate that. So thank you so much. Yeah, and I always ask people, why are you still listening?
For all the information, and it is a way of keeping in touch. And, you know, I feel I have to keep in touch to try and give whatever kind of support one can. It's pathetic, I know, but when they're facing such awful things, but one wants to back Ukraine as much as possible. And this is my tiny little way of keeping going.
No, it's not pathetic. Yeah. What is your question, Olivia, for Richard?
My question, having just listened to him though, it sounds even more depressing, but it's just, if an agreement were to be made with Russia, one always is saying, well, you know, we'd never be able to hold them to it. But it occurred to me that if Ukraine, as part of any peace agreement, were to join NATO, would that then be a deterrent for Putin to come back, to stop him coming back and invading again in a couple of years' time?
So it's an excellent question. And the first thing I'd like to latch onto is all wars end, and they generally don't end in a decisive military victory. That's the exception. They generally end when one or both of the principal protagonists realize that they can't achieve anything more by fighting other than loss and pain and grief, and that's often out of exhaustion more than anything else. The risk in the Ukraine situation, and you've just made this point, is that there is no confidence that if Russia settled, that it would then stick to the deal. It would just be a pause whilst they continue to rearm. And we should be in absolutely no doubt that as things stand, Russia will end up with a bigger, more effective set of armed forces at the end of the war in Ukraine than it started with, because it's engaged in a process of a whole of society mobilization and rearmament, and that's a big factor. However, when it comes to some form of settlement, Ukraine, and let us assume for now, and this will be contentious, that Ukraine exists not just as a sovereign state, but with a lot of the territory that it claims, but not all of it, because it has proved too difficult to take back every square inch that they currently aspire to. So in order for Ukraine to stop fighting, it's going to need guarantees against a resurgent Russian attempt. And NATO membership is, frankly, the only means that I think that would be credible, because if you join NATO, you become party to Article 5 of the treaty, which means an attack on one of the currently 32 members is an attack on them all. And therefore, if Ukraine joins NATO, if Russia were to come back for more, it would be at war with NATO. And Russia will always lose that war, even if it inflicted some sort of surprise. The challenge for Ukraine of joining NATO is the day it joins NATO, it gives up any intent to go on the offensive itself, to take back territory that it may have ceded in a negotiation. And you can't have it both ways. You can't be in NATO and harbour an intent to make war aggressively against Russia on your own in the future. That won't work. So with the security of joining NATO would come the surrender of claims on territory that it may have, in its own view, temporarily ceded.
Could I ask you about Ukraine joining NATO and what circumstances it is possible, certainly at the moment, when there is military activity taking place on Ukrainian soil? Would everything have to cease?
So I think it is inconceivable that you would get a consensus across NATO that Ukraine could join NATO whilst the war continued and there wasn't a settlement, because if it gained Article 5 eligibility, then NATO is de facto at war with Russia, and nobody is going to commit to that, certainly not in the current circumstances.
Olivia, how do you respond to what Richard has said to you?
It wouldn't be possible while a war is going on, but as part of the actual agreement to peace because of stopping Russia coming back. But yeah, I do understand that Ukraine would have to be accepting their borders as they would then stand.
Yes.
From the point of view of the rest of NATO not coming on board, if the West is serious about the war coming to an end and making sure Ukraine would have what it held then, they're going to have to back it in that way, I would have thought.
If I may, the day the fighting stops in Ukraine, whether that's next year or 5 years from now, and my view is 5 years is more likely than the next year, we will still be in this deep confrontation between President Putin, who sees the US-led West and NATO in particular as harboring seriously aggressive intent against Russia. So, for example, one of the reasons the Russian Air Force is not a major player in the war in Ukraine in the way that people like me expected is because the army, the Russian army, is focused on Ukraine and the Air Force is being kept for when NATO attacks Russia. So this discussion about what is the best way of securing Ukraine's future when the shooting stops in Ukraine is inextricably bound up with how does the West bear down on Russia in this confrontation that we didn't ask for, but we have ended up with. We are dealing with an emergency which we should have avoided, and we absolutely need to make sure ends well on our terms when we get there. And that's not necessarily military, but it will include NATO and a military arrangement.
Olivia, thank you so much for being with us on Ukrainecast. We're really grateful. Thank you. Richard, you just said 5 years is more likely this war could go on for another 5 years.
So I know we would all like it to stop, and why wouldn't we? If you just look at the terrible toll in human life and the damage to economy and built environment. But why would it stop? So Russia can afford to keep this going for at least another 3 years. It will run out of old kits to refurbish by about spring next year, but it is ramping up the production of new stuff. It's not short of people. I say recruiting to 85% of its targets. It's mobilizing its economy behind the war. And you've seen that in the appointment of the new defense minister. It's taken its defense spend to about 6.8% of GDP a year. Russia is digging in for a long war in Ukraine and in a confrontation with the West. It's almost going to define President Putin's regime until President Putin perhaps is no longer president. And on the battlefield in Ukraine, neither side has a decisive edge. And from a Ukraine perspective, to go back to the point you reminded me I made in April, they can hold the defensive line this year, probably with enough help. But in order to go back on the offensive, to build the armed force, so people who are trained and experienced, and people often underestimate how long that takes, but typically that's a 1 to 2 year challenge, plus the equipment, plus the ammunition, plus the medical support in a war that will probably cost Ukraine, if I were asked to advise on this, I would say, well, budget for 50,000 killed, wounded and taken prisoner a year for every year that you continue fighting. So for Ukraine to muster the offensive combat power to throw Russia out of the parts of Ukraine that matter most to Ukraine, it's going to take them, I think, realistically, at least a year, more likely 2 years to get ready. And then you still don't know whether it will succeed or not against what is a very well-resourced and well-established Russian defense. So unless people choose to stop fighting, this is just going to take a long time to resolve militarily.
Sure. And you said it will define President Putin's time in office. Well, also it will define President Zelensky's term in office. And his official term actually ended this week on Monday. He is extending it, though, something he can do without an election because martial law was imposed when the full-scale invasion began. And we were looking at videos, weren't we, Jamie, of when he was elected in 2019.
I'm feeling good. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
He looks a lot less grey and a lot more, well, carefree, I suppose, would be the word.
Yeah, carefree. Well, you know, this was the actor who just sounded and, you know, he was the accidental president, many people thought. But, he looks young, green and eager to start. And, yeah, very, very different from the man that we know now going around the world in his fatigues, sort of grizzled figure, the wartime president. Yeah, he's very much a young, naive, new politician. And we've actually had this question from a listener about President Zelensky and his term in office.
Hi, Ukrainecast. This is Sharon from Lincoln. Regarding President Zelensky extending his official term, I do think under the circumstances it makes sense to do this once. But if the situation drags on and he needs to extend it again, then is there any way of finding out what the Ukrainian people would prefer? Continuance and consistency, or an opportunity to reject Zelensky's position and steer their country differently?
Well, there has been some opinion polling done on this in Ukraine. The Kyiv International Institute of Sociology, respected polling institution there, and it's found that 69%, so well over two-thirds of Ukrainians, do believe that President Zelensky should continue serving until the end of martial law. Now, the levels of support for him have gone up, have gone down. They went down notably when he fired the popular commander-in-chief of the armed forces, the one who is now, of course, the ambassador here in London, Mr. Zaluzhny. But in general, there seems to be a consensus that this is not the time for an election, that he should stay in place. But that could certainly slip, depending on, I guess, Victoria, the way the war goes.
Yeah. And I suppose you might expect this, but Vladimir Putin, on his visit to China, he raised his concerns about the legitimacy of President Zelensky in case it comes to signing fateful documents. Although I'm not quite sure what that means, actually. What do you think that means?
A fateful document. That's a very good point. I mean, hopefully he's looking for some kind of deal, isn't he? But yeah, it's interesting. And of course, the other aspect, and we're going to touch on it when we discuss the Mike Pompeo interview, is what happens in America. And there have been voices in the States, someone like Senator Lindsey Graham, who's close to Donald Trump, who have suggested it would be good for President Zelensky to be re-elected, to have a Democratic mandate, and that might help, because even if the Ukrainians themselves seem comfortable about him staying on for the time being, you know, when we're looking at that all-important support from abroad, that kind of the narrative from Vladimir Putin can kind of catch on and can have some credence.
Yeah. But very, very difficult to call it an election in the middle of a war, obviously.
Of course, all sorts of reasons. I mean, displaced people, soldiers fighting, and of course, just pure security. How do you secure polling stations in these kind of circumstances?
Yeah. Now, Richard, on our podcast last week, we had Mike Pompeo with us. It was really interesting. Obviously, he was very close to Donald Trump, former US Secretary of State under Trump, former CIA director. And we asked him about Mr. Trump's pledge to end the war in Ukraine within 24 hours if he was re-elected later this year.
Oh, I don't know about the 24 hours. What he meant is that he will immediately turn to this task and we will quickly begin to restore a process which can lead to peace, where this is resolved in the end. This is up to convincing Vladimir Putin about cost and putting President Zelensky in a position where he can receive an outcome that is acceptable to him and the Ukrainian people. That should be the objective for the United States of America, for Europe and for NATO.
We got this question from Peter in Nottingham here in the UK. He says, I was struck by the Mike Pompeo episode, which took me quite off guard. I don't like Trump and I wasn't convinced by everything he said, but what got me was his context around the end of the war in 24 hours quote that has become so famous. His interpretation was different to that which has been widely reported since Trump mentioned it. His view was that they would support Ukraine more than the Biden administration had. They will do it properly. Do we believe this?
His main point, Richard, was that when Donald Trump was president, President Putin did not go into Ukraine. And when Joe Biden becomes president, President Putin finds the courage to invade a sovereign nation. He was basically saying Trump is a supporter of democracy and Ukraine. Do you buy that?
So I think it's very difficult to be sure. And Mr. Trump's record is one of almost spectacular inconsistency. And we're in an election campaign now, and who knows where we end up in November. But I think the point that Mike Pompeo, I completely agree with on, is what happens in Ukraine and what happens in this confrontation with Russia is absolutely vital to not just Western security, but the US-led West place in the world. And we know this because President Putin, he said only this week in his discussion with President Xi of China, that they're in an alliance to push back against this alleged Western-led hegemony, where, in the way that the US as a single superpower for a while did seem to dominate our world and how it was going to work and the institutions which we used to run it with. So if the US walks away from Ukraine, and Ukraine has to stop fighting because it doesn't have the means to fight with, and that's, as I say, because Europe can't pick up the gap, then Russia will be vindicated in its ambition to reset an empire on its periphery. It will have affirmed to itself that the West has no stomach for a fight and is in decline, and then will feel at liberty to look at other parts of Europe in particular, which might fall under this Russian imperial ambition. And in doing all that, yes, of course, the US might feel free to focus more on China, but not just China, but China and Africa and parts of Asia will see what has happened and will not trust the West and its security guarantees, and they will cleave to other powers in the world, not least, I think, China. And so a relatively modest effort from the West that assures a good outcome for Ukraine, assures a good outcome for Western security. And it would be much better if Mr. Trump was really able to bend American power to do that, because the amount of money involved, the amount of industrial effort is really very small. Typically, for every country in the West, about 0.5% of GDP will sort this out. And so much better that Russia is contained into a better place as a result of a good outcome in Ukraine than we end up with a major confrontation between Russia and US-led NATO, with all the potential consequences of that.
And I think the other point about Mike Pompeo, which is interesting, is yes, there are people like him around Donald Trump who are supportive of Ukraine and do want Ukraine to prevail in this, and that there are others as well. But of course, there are some in Congress who think the opposite. But interestingly, you know, when push eventually came to shove, with Donald Trump's tacit support, because loyalty to him is absolutely imperative for anyone who's a Republican politician in the United States, they did, with a few exceptions, sign up to the aid package. So it's, you know, there's a sort of tug of war, I think, within the Trump camp as well about where this should go. And that will be interesting to watch as the election campaign develops.
We should be absolutely clear that from February 2022 onwards, President Putin has assumed that when Mr. Trump is re-elected, which in his view is the outcome, the US will walk away and he will have established the West has no stomach for this kind of thing, and Russia will prevail and prevail reasonably quickly. So Mr. Trump taking a position which is the reverse of that would be a major strategic shock to President Putin and his ambitions, to the much greater benefit of Western security and indeed the Western position in what is going to be a much harder and contested world.
Richard, thank you very much for your time on Ukrainecast today. We really appreciate your insight. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you, Richard. That was great to have you.
No, my pleasure.
Jamie, before we go, we should mention, over the weekend, a Ukrainian, Oleksandr Usyk, became the undisputed heavyweight world champion when he beat Tyson Fury.
By split decision from Ukraine, Oleksandr!
Why is this significant for Ukraine?
Well, it's significant. Obviously, any big sporting win is good for morale. But I think it's important because, boxing has a particular place in Ukraine. The person that Tyson Fury, I think, beat to become world champion was one Vladimir Klitschko. And, of course, his brother, Vitaly Klitschko, also a former world heavyweight boxing champion, is now the mayor of Kyiv. So, you know, this is a path to a political career if one wants it in Ukraine. And I have to remember when I was, I think, covering the 2010 election, possibly, maybe it was after that. Anyway, it's one of the elections that Vladimir Klitschko ran in to become president of Ukraine. His party was actually called Udar, which means punch. So, yeah, politics and boxing very much intertwined in Ukraine.
Thank you for that. And thank you for being with us on Ukrainecast. And to our listeners, do keep sending in your messages. And wherever you are listening in the world, take care.
Goodbye.
Ukrainecast from BBC News.